9. Growth. Why do we grow bigger? Why do we grow older? Birthday parties mean a lot to young children. For weeks beforehand, they talk about who they are going to invite, where they are going to hold their party, and what they are going to do. And for good reason. Birthday parties are a confluence of many important events in a child's life. They are an opportunity for social recognition and esteem. They are an opportunity for special foods, cake, and material rewards, presents. They mark a change in status among a child's peers. And of course, they mark a change in age. This last event is the most mysterious. Birthdays are a commemoration of the day we were born, but children have no recollection of that day, nor do they understand the meaning of birth as a biological origin. For all they know, they've always existed as an independent being, and they have no idea that their age reflects the number of years that have passed since a time when they didn't exist as an independent being. Children know that 4-year-olds are bigger, smarter, and more capable than 3-year-olds, and that 3-year-olds are bigger, smarter, and more capable than 2-year-olds. But the numerical meaning of those labels is lost on them. To a child, an age is just a social identifier, like a name or an address. When my son Teddy turned 4, it took him a couple of months to remember that he was no longer 3. When prompted for his age, he would say, 3, and I would remind him that he was now 4. Once, when prompted for his age, he turned to me and said, "Daddy, I forget. What's my number's name?" Age, at its core, is a biological concept, a numerical index of growth. And children must come to understand how and why people grow before they can understand how and why people age. Accordingly, the birthday party and its age-changing repercussions are topics of much curiosity among preschoolers. Many preschoolers associate the party itself with the process of aging. They think that if you miss a birthday party, you'll miss the opportunity to age. Researchers have explored children's beliefs on the matter with this thought experiment. Suppose there was a boy whose mother got sick and could not give him a birthday party. The following year, she decided to give him a birthday party not only once, like everybody else has, but rather again and again until he is older than everybody else. One birthday for age 5, like his friends, and then quickly another birthday for age 6, and then a few days later, one for age 7. What do you think? Is that a good idea? When this thought experiment was proposed to children between the ages of 4 and 7, few of the oldest children thought it would work, but nearly all of the youngest children thought it would. Children who claim that missing a birthday party will delay aging, or that having an extra birthday party will hasten aging, lack what psychologists term a vitalistic theory of biology. Vitalism is the idea that living things possess an internal energy, or life force, that allows those things to move and to grow. This life force is depleted through daily activity, but can be replenished by eating, drinking, or sleeping. From a scientific point of view, vitalism seems to be nothing more than a gloss for metabolic functioning. Our life force is our biochemical supply of energy. But vitalism can stand on its own with no understanding of the tissues or organs that instantiate metabolic functions. In the history of biology, vitalism predated materialistic or mechanistic conceptions of life by thousands of years. The notion of a life force has gone by different names in different cultures: elan vital, spiritus animus, chakra, chi, the soul, the humors. But its purpose is always the same: to explain the seemingly unexplainable processes of health, locomotion, intention, perception, growth, and development. Vitalism, in its strongest formulation, is incompatible with a biochemical view of life because it implies that life cannot be reduced to mere matter. But in weaker formulations, it implies only that external activities depend on some kind of internal energy and is thus compatible with a biochemical view of life. Vitalism provides the outline for how living systems function, and biochemistry fills in the details. From a developmental point of view, vitalism is a stepping stone to more complex conceptions of life, like the mechanistic conceptions discussed in Chapter 8. Many years before children endorse mechanistic explanations for biological phenomena, they endorse vitalistic ones. Given a choice between a vitalistic explanation for why we eat food, because our stomach takes in energy from the food, and a mechanistic explanation, because we take food into our body after the food is changed in our stomach, preschoolers and young elementary schoolers prefer the vitalistic explanation to the mechanistic one. The same goes for other bodily functions. Asked why we have hearts, young children prefer the vitalistic explanation, because our heart works hard to send out energy with our blood, to the mechanistic explanation, because the heart works like a pump and pushes our blood around. Asked why we breathe air, young children prefer the vitalistic explanation, because our chest takes in energy from the air, to the mechanistic explanation, because our lungs take in oxygen and change it into carbon dioxide. Older children and adults, on the other hand, prefer mechanistic explanations to vitalistic ones. The vitalistic ones strike us as shallow. Another sign that children develop vitalistic conceptions of life before mechanistic ones is that their beliefs about vital functions don't align with their beliefs about what is alive and what is not. Consider these entities: humans, bears, squirrels, birds, fish, beetles, worms, trees, bushes, dandelions, rocks, water, wind, the sun, bicycles, scissors, and pencils. Which of them grow? Which of them are alive? To adults, both questions merit the same answer. We know that everything on that list that grows is alive, and everything that is alive grows. But to preschoolers and young elementary schoolers, the two questions merit different answers. They recognize that the first 10 entities, humans through dandelions, grow, and that the last 7, rocks through pencils, do not. But they also think that trees, bushes, and dandelions are not alive, and that the wind and the sun are alive. Not until age 9 do children recognize that life and growth are intimately related. The same is true for needing water, needing nutrients, and getting sick. Several years before children recognize that plants are alive, they recognize that these three properties nevertheless apply to plants. Recognizing that something is alive requires a mechanistic conception of life, whereas recognizing that something eats, drinks, grows, or gets sick requires only a vitalistic conception of life. A child recognizes that plants possess vital powers long before he or she recognizes where and how those vital powers are physically instantiated. This disassociation between vitalistic, energy-based notions of life and mechanistic, body-based notions of life has consequences for how children learn biological concepts. For instance, it's common practice in kindergarten classrooms to grow plants as a foray into basic physiology, but doing so hardly convinces children that plants are alive. By kindergarten, children know that plants grow and develop, and that plants need water and nutrients, just like animals. But observing those processes firsthand does not help a child see that plants are similar to animals at a more fundamental level, that their vital powers are both instantiated by internal tissues and organs. For children of this age, vital powers are not distinctly biological. Consider again the concept of growth. Young children understand that growth entails change in shape and size, but they do not understand that growth entails change in life status. Their idea of growth is akin to how crystals grow, or how clouds grow. Crystals and clouds do indeed grow. The term applies literally, not just metaphorically, but their growth is the byproduct of non-biological processes and thus has different implications. Crystals and clouds grow bigger, but not more complex, and their growth has no functional consequences for the entity as a whole. When children claim that plants grow, they mean simply that plants get bigger. Vitalism may set the stage for relating growth to life, but growth is not seen as a consequence of life until life is seen as a consequence of the inner workings of the body. Growth can be observed, but it cannot be interpreted. Children must posit an extra, unobservable layer to reality, the layer of the body and all its hidden organs. One litmus test for whether children hold a vitalistic theory of life, aside from their beliefs about plants, is whether they understand the nutritional value of food. Food is integral to growth and health, but it's also integral to social customs and social norms. What we eat is dictated as much by social considerations as by biological ones. Daily routines, cereal is eaten for breakfast but not dinner, hamburgers are eaten for dinner but not breakfast, cultural taboos, Americans eat curdled milk in the form of cheese but not fermented cabbage, Koreans eat fermented cabbage in the form of kimchi but not curdled milk, religious taboos, Muslims eat beef but not pork, Hindus eat pork but not beef, and dietary restrictions. Vegetarians eat dairy products but not meat. People with lactose intolerance eat meat but not dairy products. Layered on top of these social considerations are food-related buzzwords: carbs, gluten, antioxidants, additives, preservatives, processed, probiotic, organic, free-range, whole grain. These words have technical definitions, but they've also picked up moral connotations, connotations of inherent goodness or inherent badness. This morass of socio-moral information makes it difficult for children to determine the causal properties of food, let alone what they should and should not eat. When my daughter Lucy was 4 and a half, she was particularly fixated on one property of food: protein. We saw her fixation manifest itself in unexpected ways, as in the following conversation about a bad dream. Lucy:
I had a bad dream. I was being chased by pirates.
Me:
Try to think about something else, something happy.
Lucy:
I want to think about happy things, like mermaids and dolphins, but my brain won't let me.
Me: You control your brain. Tell your brain to think about mermaids and dolphins. Lucy:
I can't. I didn't eat enough protein.
Lucy had glommed onto protein as critical for bodily functions because her teachers at school had advised her to eat her lunch foods protein first. Example, pepperoni before pretzels. At age 4, Lucy frequently let us know what on her plate was a protein and what was not, and much of the time she was wrong. Her analysis was biased by what she wanted to eat. Donuts have protein, and what she did not. Eggs don't have any protein. 4-year-olds in general are surprisingly bad at discerning the nutritional value of food. They have yet to disentangle the biological dimensions of eating, what we should eat, from either its social dimensions, what we see others eat, or its psychological dimensions, what we want to eat. In one study, researchers asked 4-year-olds to classify the following foods as healthy or unhealthy: bacon, beans, broccoli, cake, carrots, celery, Cheetos, corn, donuts, fudge, potato chips, and red pepper. Half the list consisted of vegetables, and half consisted of junk food. But the 4-year-olds were largely oblivious to the difference. They classified vegetables as healthy only 70% of the time, and they classified junk food as healthy 47% of the time. Apparently, many 4-year-olds think that bacon and potato chips are as healthy as celery and red pepper. I once stumbled on similar misconceptions in my own children. My son was 7 and my daughter was 3, and we were at the pediatrician's office for a wellness visit. The pediatrician asked my daughter what her favorite vegetable was, and she yelled, "Watermelon." "That's not a vegetable," corrected the pediatrician. "That's a fruit." The pediatrician then turned to my son and asked him the same question. "Macaroni," he said. "Oh, my," the pediatrician exclaimed. "This doesn't reflect well on your parents." Fortunately for us parents, children's food-based misconceptions are correctable. In a follow-up study to the one described before, researchers exposed 4-year-olds to one of 2 tutorials on healthy eating, a prescriptive tutorial and a vitalistic tutorial. The prescriptive tutorial advised children on what they should and should not eat. For example, healthy foods give your body what it needs. There are many healthy foods you should eat a lot of. Vegetables are healthy foods. Examples of vegetables are beans, celery, carrots, broccoli, and corn. You should eat vegetables every day. The vitalistic tutorial provided the same information but couched it in an explicitly vitalistic framework, which the researchers denoted with italics. Healthy foods give your body what it needs because they have many vitamins. Vitamins are inside of healthy foods. Vitamins help you grow, give you long-lasting energy, and keep you from getting sick. There are many healthy foods you should eat a lot of. For example, vegetables are healthy foods because they have many vitamins inside of them. Examples of vegetables that have many vitamins inside are beans, celery, carrots, broccoli, and corn. These foods help you grow, give you long-lasting energy, and keep you from getting sick. You should eat vegetables every day. The tutorials also covered unhealthy foods, either in a prescriptive context, you should not eat foods with a lot of fat every day, or in a vitalistic context, high-fat foods do not have vitamins that help you grow. Both tutorials took the same amount of time to complete, and both provided children with a basis for deciding whether a food is healthy or unhealthy. Only the vitalistic tutorial, however, proved effective. Children who received this tutorial made significantly better healthy versus unhealthy judgments after the tutorial than before, and it proved effective both immediately after the tutorial and 5 months later. Emphasizing the vitalistic properties of food allowed children to reconceptualize food from a source of pleasure or displeasure to a source of nutrition or lack thereof. The food industry also seems to have recognized the effectiveness of vitalistic arguments, as it has increasingly emphasized nutritional information in its marketing of healthy foods to adults. Adults know, in the abstract, that vegetables are healthier than junk food, but companies like Whole Foods and Trader Joe's have found it useful and profitable to remind adults of the health consequences of the foods they sell. Kale, seaweed, and acai have thus been elevated from bland plant matter to superfoods. Twinkies, Big Macs, and orange soda, on the other hand, have been degraded from tasty treats to silent killers. Human foods aside, an even stronger test of whether children hold a vitalistic theory of life is whether they recognize that food can take different forms across the biological world and that substances that humans do not consume can still have nutritional value for other organisms. Humans consume only a small slice of the organic world, after all. Food options that humans are not equipped to utilize include wood, consumed by termites, beetles, etc., plankton, consumed by whales, jellyfish, etc., and dung, consumed by flies, fungi, etc. The idea that something inedible to humans may be edible to other organisms makes sense only if food is understood as a source of nutrition. When my son Teddy was 3.5, he had yet to acquire such an understanding, as illustrated in this conversation about mosquitoes. Teddy: "What does a mosquito bite look like?" Me: "It's round and red and itchy." Teddy: "Do mosquitoes have big teeth?" Me: No, they have pokey little things they use to suck your blood.
Teddy.
Why do they suck my blood?
Me. Because that's what mosquitoes eat for food.
Teddy.
Blood isn't food. Chicken is food.
Me. You eat chicken, but mosquitoes eat blood.
Teddy.
Will a mosquito bite my transformer?
Me.
No, your transformer doesn't have any blood.
Teddy's conception of food was grounded in taste, not sustenance. He would eventually learn to identify food with sustenance, but doing so required adopting a vitalistic framework for reasoning about biological processes in general. Acquiring this framework is not a given. Individuals with intellectual disabilities sometimes never do. We know this from studies of a particular form of intellectual disability, Williams syndrome. This syndrome is a rare genetic disorder resulting in low intelligence but normal language skills. Adults with Williams syndrome lack much of the knowledge acquired by other adults during childhood, but because they have normal language skills, they can converse about their knowledge in ways that individuals with other forms of cognitive disabilities cannot. Intrigued by this unusual combination of abilities, psychologist Susan Johnson and her colleagues sought to determine whether adults with Williams syndrome ever acquire a vitalistic conception of biology. Accordingly, they interviewed a sample of adults with Williams syndrome on their understanding of several biological concepts, including life, death, growth, metabolism, reproduction, and inheritance. During the interviews, Johnson and her colleagues discovered that one of their participants, a 21-year-old woman with a below-average IQ but average verbal ability, was fascinated by the mythology of vampires. She had read several vampire novels and was eager to share her knowledge of vampires with Johnson and her co-workers. The researchers were, in turn, eager to hear what she had to say, as vampires defy the very biological principles targeted by their interviews. "What exactly is a vampire?" they asked.
"Ooh," she replied, "a vampire is a man who climbs into ladies' bedrooms in the middle of the night and sinks his teeth into their necks."
The researchers then asked why vampires do this, and the woman was visibly taken aback.
"I've never thought about that," she said.
After a long pause, she offered an explanation.
"Vampires must have an inordinate fondness for necks."
Despite a long-standing interest in vampire lore, this woman had not constructed a vitalistic interpretation of vampires' chief activity, drinking blood, nor was she able to construct one when prompted to do so. Instead, she defaulted to a psychological interpretation of the activity, surmising that vampires drink blood because they want to drink blood, not because they need to drink blood. On the whole, Johnson observed that adults with Williams syndrome rarely construct vitalistic interpretations of biological phenomena. All biological phenomena, not just those related to vampires. Adults who have Williams syndrome know the names of dozens of animals and the activities they engage in, but they show little understanding of why animals engage in these activities, why they eat, why they grow, why they die. In fact, these adults' understanding of biological activities is more similar to a 4-year-old's understanding than it is to a 9-year-old's, let alone to a fellow adult's. Knowing a lot of biological facts does not guarantee an understanding of those facts, either a vitalistic understanding or a more detailed mechanistic understanding. Both types of understanding must be actively constructed, and adults with Williams syndrome appear to lack the cognitive resources needed to undertake that construction. As we have seen, our theories of biology shape our beliefs about food, what constitutes food, why we eat food, and how food promotes growth and health. Our theories of biology also shape our decisions about which foods to eat and which to avoid, beginning in childhood. Children are notoriously picky eaters. They reject foods high in vitamins and minerals, vegetables, and focus instead on foods high in sugars, breads, or fats, dairy. Getting children to eat their vegetables is a perennial challenge. But children can be convinced to eat vegetables on their own accord if they are taught the vitalistic rationale behind doing so. Psychologist Sarah Gripsover and her colleagues made this observation in a study comparing preschoolers' food choices with their understanding of the nutritional value of food. Preschoolers who participated in the study were taught five vitalistic principles. 1. That people need to eat a variety of foods, not just one type. 2. That foods of the same type can take a variety of forms. 3. That food contains microscopic elements known as nutrients. 4. That nutrients are extracted from food by our stomachs and then carried to other parts of the body by our blood. And 5. That nutrients are required for all biological activities, from high-octane activities like running and climbing to low-octane activities like thinking and writing. When children learn these principles, they change their eating habits as well. At snack time, they voluntarily selected 9 pieces of vegetables, twice as many as those selected by children who had not received the vitalism tutorial. In fact, children who received the vitalism tutorial added more vegetables to their plate than even children who received a nutrition tutorial created by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA. Unlike Gripsover's tutorial, the USDA tutorial did not emphasize the biological benefits of healthy eating. Instead, it emphasized the enjoyment of healthy eating, a message the children simply didn't buy. Connections between healthy eating and beliefs about nutrition have been documented in adults as well. Adults may bemoan how children choose fatty foods and sugary foods over vegetables, but most adults, particularly American adults, are equally guilty of overindulging their appetite for such foods. American adults weigh more today than ever before. For decades, we have been consuming more calories than we need, overeating, and burning fewer calories than we should, underexercising. Both overeating and underexercising contribute to weight gain, but ask yourself, which is the primary cause? Medical experts cite overeating as the primary cause. Exercise by itself has only marginal effects on weight gain if overeating is not addressed as well. Nevertheless, many people hold the opposite view, and this view has significant consequences for their health. Those who cite under-exercising as the primary cause of weight gain have a 9% higher body mass index, BMI, than those who cite overeating as the primary cause. This result has been obtained in several countries, the United States, France, China, South Korea, and it has been shown to be independent of other factors known to influence a person's BMI, including gender, level of education, hours of sleep per night, chronic stress, pre-existing medical conditions, current socioeconomic status, childhood socioeconomic status, pregnancy status, employment status, self-reported health, interest in nutrition, tobacco use, and self-esteem. Even after controlling for all these factors, individuals who cite exercise as more consequential than diet still have higher BMIs than those who cite diet as more consequential than exercise. Researchers have actually observed the detrimental effects of an exercise-based theory of weight gain firsthand. In one study, they asked participants to complete a questionnaire on weight-related beliefs and weight-related behaviors while given the opportunity to snack on chocolate. Each participant was given a cup of individually wrapped chocolates, and those who overvalued exercise relative to diet, as revealed by their questionnaires, ate more chocolates than those who did not. In other words, overweight adults, while completing a questionnaire about their weight gain, engaged in the very behavior that led to that weight gain. Clearly, an intervention is in order. So far, our discussion of growth has focused on beliefs about what promotes growth, and health more generally,
but our intuitive theories of growth have a second dimension as well. Beliefs about what changes because of growth. These beliefs are shaped not by vitalism, but by a different cognitive bias known as essentialism. Essentialism is the idea that an organism's outward appearance and behavior are products of its inner nature, or essence. As the organism grows, its appearance and behavior may change, but its essence stays the same. In fact, the essence is what drives the change in appearance and behavior. According to this line of thinking, an organism inherits its essence from its parents, thereby inheriting the potential to develop species-typical traits. Cows and pigs, for instance, are thought to inherit fundamentally different essences. The cow's essence propels it to develop horns, udders, and an appetite for grass, whereas the pig's essence propels it to develop pink skin, a curly tail, and an appetite for slop. We don't use the term essence in everyday parlance, but the idea pervades our thinking about growth and development anyway. Consider all the familiar stories in which the protagonist's true nature is masked by an unfortunate or unusual turn of events, only to shine through in the end. The Ugly Duckling, The Frog Prince, The Fox and the Hound, Cinderella, Beauty and the Beast, The Sword and the Stone, The Princess and the Pea. Most of these stories are about people, not animals, but their plots are essentialist all the same. The protagonists at their core are different from what the other characters perceive them to be, but they are destined to defy those perceptions. Some ducklings are destined to become swans, and some peasants are destined to become princesses. Because essentialist tales are enjoyed by children and adults alike, it seems likely that children do not have to be taught to think in essentialist terms, that essentialism develops on its own without any special experience or instruction. Psychologists have looked into the matter, and their studies support this idea. Children are essentialists from the moment they first ponder how and why organisms change with growth. The psychologist who pioneered the study of essentialism in young children was Susan Gelman. She and her colleagues have probed children's essentialist intuition in several ways, but the most straightforward is with a thought experiment similar to the story of the Ugly Duckling. "I'm going to tell you about a cow named Edith. Right after Edith was born, when she was just a tiny baby cow, she was taken to a farm that had pigs, lots of pigs. The pigs took care of Edith. Edith grew up on the farm with all the pigs, and she never saw another cow. When Edith got to be a grown-up, what did her tail look like? Was it straight or was it curly? When Edith got to be a grown-up, what sound did she make? Did she say moo or did she say oink?" This thought experiment pits an organism's upbringing against its parentage as the source of species-specific growth, and children typically side with parentage. By age 4, they claim that Edith will grow to have a straight tail and say moo, and if the story was reversed, if children were told that Edith was sired by pigs but raised by cows, they claim that Edith will grow to have a curly tail and say oink. The particular animals and the particular traits included in the story do not matter. 4-year-olds claim that a kangaroo raised by goats will grow to be good at hopping, not climbing. That a tiger raised by horses will grow to have striped fur, not plain fur. And that a rabbit raised by monkeys will grow to eat carrots, not bananas. 4-year-olds even recognize that a seed from a lemon planted in an orange orchard will grow to yield lemons, not oranges. Which is impressive considering that children of this age do not even think that plants are alive. Researchers have posed thought experiments about cross-species adoption to Brazilian children, Israeli children, Mayan children from Mexico, Vezo children from Madagascar, and Menominee children from Wisconsin, and all agree that the adopted animal will grow to exhibit the traits of its birth parents, not its adopted parents. Essentialist beliefs about growth thus appear to be universal. In fact, these beliefs are so commonplace
that they crop up in contexts where an essentialist analysis is patently inappropriate. One such context is human sociology. Social categories like race, ethnicity, occupation, religion, and socioeconomic class have little biological coherence, if any, but many of us essentialize these categories nonetheless, treating them as stable, discrete, uniform, and psychologically informative. Children in particular are prone to essentialize social categories. They think the members of distinct social categories are as different from one another as are the members of distinct species. When 7-year-olds are asked to rate the similarity between members of different social categories, say, Arabs and Jews or rich people and poor people, they rate them only slightly more similar than they rate two animals of different species. They claim, for instance, that rich people and poor people differ in their preferences, appearance, behavior, and physiology as much as elephants differ from lions along those same dimensions. Children thus treat social categories similarly to biological categories, imbuing the members of those categories with different innate potentials. Another context in which essentialist notions of growth are misapplied is organ donation. Organs are attributed essences, just like full organisms are, the essence of the person who has that organ. As an illustration, imagine the following scenario. Doctors have discovered that you have a defective heart and that it needs to be replaced to prevent serious health consequences down the line. Someone else's heart will need to be transplanted into your body. Unfortunately, the list of heart donors is limited, and the only available donor is a serial killer. Would you accept the serial killer's heart? How about the heart of a schizophrenic patient, or the heart of a pig? Most people are reluctant to accept hearts from any of those donors because they conceive of the heart as imbued with the donor's essence. When asked to imagine how their personality or behavior might change after a transplant, most people think that these aspects of themselves, personality and behavior, would change significantly, becoming similar to those of the donor. Such perceptions are not limited to heart transplants. Blood transfusions and gene therapies are also thought to alter one's personality and behavior. A middle-aged woman who received a heart and lung transplant from an 18-year-old man who loved beer and motorcycles wrote an entire memoir about how her personality and interests become aligned with his. She named her memoir, quite aptly, A Change of Heart. From a scientific point of view, beliefs about transferring an essence from one person to another, or from one species to another, are preposterous. But essentialism is not scientific. It is a pre-scientific notion of inheritance in the same way that vitalism is a pre-scientific notion of metabolism. It wreaks havoc not only on our notions of growth and development, but also on three other biological notions discussed in later chapters. Genetics, Chapter 10, Evolutionary Adaptation, Chapter 12, and The Origin of Species, Chapter 13. Essentialism, for all its trouble, allows us to map different physical states to the same organism across development, from calf to cow, piglet to pig, gosling to goose. We can even map vastly different physical states to the same organism, from caterpillar to pupa to butterfly, egg to tadpole to frog, seed to sapling to tree. We recognize not only that an organism retains its species identity as it grows, but also how this identity unfolds over time, affecting its appearance and behavior. Oddly, we have much more trouble tracking personal identity over time, particularly our own identity. From a preschooler's point of view, people never change, at least not that much. Some people appear to have been placed on the earth as children, and others as adults. The idea that children grow into adults is not as intuitive as it might seem. Take, for example, the following conversation between the psychologist Susan Carey and her daughter Eliza when Eliza was 3.5. Daughter,
when I grow up,
there won't be a little girl named Eliza around here anymore.
Mother. That's right. Daughter.
Will you go out and buy another one?
Mother.
Oh, no, we love the Eliza we have, and we won't need to. What do you think will happen to you when you grow up?
Daughter.
I'll be a teacher.
Mother.
But what will your name be?
Daughter.
Satu,
the name of her favorite preschool teacher.
Carrie and her daughter had conversations like this for several weeks as her daughter tried to make sense of how she could remain the same person as she transitioned from a child to an adult. Carrie knew that her daughter had finally made sense of the conundrum when she asked,
"Mommy, when you were a little girl, was your name Susan?"
I remember going through a similar episode with my son, Teddy. It started when he was 4 and a half, and we were playing a card sequencing game. The objective of the game was to put 4 cards in chronological order from the beginning of a causal sequence to the end. So, given cards depicting an apple pie, apples on a tree, sliced apples, and apples in a bushel, the objective was to recognize that they were the steps to making an apple pie, and that they should be sequenced accordingly. Apples on a tree, apples in a bushel, sliced apples, apple pie. The game is trivial for adults, but challenging for preschoolers. For Teddy, one set of cards was particularly challenging. Baby, child, young man, old man. He couldn't discern that the underlying causal relationship was growth, and when I sequenced the cards for him, he looked astonished.
"Why is that the right order?" he asked.
Then, after staring intently at the cards, he blurted out,
"Am I going to become an old man?"
The game sparked several angst-ridden conversations about growth and aging over the next month. In one conversation, at bedtime, I became aware of the source of Teddy's angst.
"Me. Go to sleep. You need to get lots of sleep so you can grow."
Teddy.
"I'm going to grow bigger and bigger, and then, am I going to grow into an old man?"
Me.
"Not for a long, long time. You have to grow into a big boy, and then a teenager, and then a young man, and then a daddy."
Teddy.
"But when I'm an old man, how will I get back to my real self?"
Me.
"Your real self?"
Teddy.
"How will I get my arms back and my legs back?"
Teddy couldn't fathom how his physical body would come to resemble that of an old man. Where would his current body go? The gradual and continuous nature of aging was lost on him, as he hadn't observed much aging in his 4 short years. For all he knew, the old people in his life had always been old. What cruel trick of nature turns young people into old people? My daughter Lucy, at age 5, exhibited a different but equally compelling misconception about growth. At a science museum, she was prompted to draw a picture of herself in the future. She actually drew 3, which she labeled, "I am rich," "I am rich and old," and "I am dead." In each picture, she drew her entire family. We were all in caskets in the "I am dead" picture. And in each depiction of her family, she depicted herself as half the size of her parents. That is, she depicted herself as a child. She knew she would someday get old and die, but she had not yet figured out what that meant biologically. She also had not figured out that her parents were likely to die long before she did. Children's confusion about aging is tied up with their confusion about biological processes in general, as they have yet to connect aging and growth. We come to make that connection in the early years of schooling, but we may never fully grasp the ramifications of such a connection. Even as adults, we have trouble accepting the inevitable changes wrought by age, both physical changes,
gray hair, sagging skin, expanding waistlines, and psychological changes, new attitudes, new values, new interests. Indeed, psychologists have found that we are particularly oblivious to the latter. If you ask 20-year-olds how much their preferences have changed over the last decade, their preferred music, foods, hobbies, and friends, they claim that those preferences have changed a lot, an average of 40%. If you then ask those 20-year-olds how much they expect their current preferences to change over the next decade, they claim that those preferences will change much less, an average of 25%. In other words, they recognize that they didn't always prefer Taylor Swift to other musicians, sushi to other foods, and yoga to other hobbies, but they think that they will continue to prefer Taylor Swift, sushi, and yoga over the next decade. Perhaps 20-year-olds' reflections on the increased stability of their preferences are correct. The teenage years, after all, are a time of rapid growth, and the preferences that emerge by the end of that period may be more stable than those held before. The problem with this interpretation is that 30-year-olds report the same expectation as 20-year-olds, that their preferences will change less over the next decade than they changed over the past decade. And 40-year-olds report the same expectation as 30-year-olds, and 50-year-olds report the same set of expectation as 40-year-olds. People of all ages, it turns out, rate their current preferences as more stable than their past preferences. We are convinced that the last decade of our life was more identity-forming than the next decade will be, and we hold this conviction for many aspects of our identity, including our personality, example, our degree of openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism, and our core values, example, the value we place on achievement, hedonism, self-direction, benevolence, tradition, conformity, security, and power. Thus, even adults hold misapprehensions about the extent to which our personal identities change over time. We adults have observed many such changes firsthand, but we still chronically underestimate the changes in store for our future. At any given moment, we think we've arrived at the final phase of identity formation, the culmination of our character development. So while we may be more adept than children at recognizing the possibility of physical change with age, we're not particularly adept at recognizing the possibility of psychological change with age. Our current self is always our real self, our once and future identity.